Dr. Hoffman here. This Intelligent Medicine podcast is brought to you by Super Beets. Beets are a nutritional gold mine, full of antioxidants and nutrients, but they're a mess to prepare. So just mix Super Beets with 4 ounces of water and boost circulation, relax arteries, and maintain healthy blood pressure. Get the Dr. Hoffman special offer at intelligentbeets.com. That's intelligentbeets.com. Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and today it is my distinct pleasure to share with you a very, very important initiative, an initiative that hopefully will have a big impact on the health of Americans. You know, Americans in this generation, there are questions as to whether the generations to come will continue the progress that previous generations have made. Each generation in past decades has exceeded the life expectancy of the previous generation, but with the current situation, we're wondering if, despite all the life-saving interventions that are being developed, high-tech medicine, so on and so forth, whether future generations will succumb earlier to degenerative diseases. There's an epidemic of degenerative diseases, and to some extent, it's a matter of sedentary lifestyle. To some extent, it's a matter of pollution. We cover those topics frequently here on Intelligent Medicine, but of course, it's a lot about diet. And today we're going to talk to the director of a very important initiative, the Healthy Nation Coalition. We're going to tell you about that in just a moment, but it promises to influence government to change our dietary guidelines for the better. We talked to Denise Minger earlier this year, the beginning of 2014, about Death by Food Pyramid. That's a great title of a book that she has written that criticizes the way we got to our current dietary recommendations. Well, today's guest is planning to do something about it. She is Adele Height. She recently completed a Master's of Public Health Health Registered Dietitian program at University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. And she's planning on completing a PhD program in nutrition epidemiology. How appropriate. But her current work is in the area of public health advocacy. And she's making waves, and she's issued a call to action for us to take a look at the current dietary guidelines and change them for the better. So without further ado, here's our guest, Adele Height. Adele, it's a pleasure having you here on Intelligent Medicine.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's my pleasure. So what's the deal here? We have now something called the Healthy Nation Coalition, which you started. You're the director. What's the rationale for that? Why are we doing this?
Well, you mentioned Denise Minger and the conversation about how we have these guidelines that don't seem to be working. They were created back in 1977, 1980. They were supposed to prevent obesity and chronic disease. Since that time, we've seen dramatic increases in chronic disease. We've seen dramatic increases in obesity. And nothing is being done about them. I mean, it's sort of as simple as that. Every time the dietary guidelines roll around, every 5 years, you have industry groups and you have special interest groups who complain about this or that not being promoted or should be promoted within the dietary guidelines. But nobody seems to be concerned about the fact that these guidelines, which were established to prevent disease, have done exactly the opposite. And if nothing else, as policy, as Americans, we should be offended by the perpetuation of policy that simply, it not only doesn't work, it does the opposite of what it's intended to do.
Well, in talking to Denise earlier this year, and you can get the podcast at drhoffman.com to listen to the full podcast or read the book, Death by Food Pyramid, it seems that part of the problem is that the Department of Agriculture, the USDA, has a conflicted mission. On the one hand, it's supposed to improve the health of Americans through better food. On the other hand, it's supposed to promote agriculture. And so if you were to say that one or another foodstuff maybe isn't so great for Americans to consume, you're going to have lobbyists knocking at the door of legislators and at federal agencies saying, wait a minute, you know, we're getting in the way of commerce here. All foods are good. They should be consumed in moderation, blah, blah, blah.
Well, that's an interesting narrative. and it's not that there's no truth to that, because certainly industry has influence over, they certainly contribute to the commentary that goes on around the guidelines. But there are really two points that I want to make with this.
Sure.
Which is that when the guidelines were created, within the food industry, there were winners and there were losers. So the food industry is not a monolith. There are players that benefit. These players were the folks who make vegetable oil, so corn and soybean oil and canola oil, grain and cereal manufacturers. So the wheat folks definitely benefited, corn benefited, soy benefited. It's not a coincidence that these are our top three subsidized crops, and they all did benefit from the dietary guidelines. But there are sectors of the food industry that didn't, and those were the meat producers primarily and the egg producers. Those folks did not benefit, and at the bottom of the whole chain of production, the farmers, our independent farmers, definitely were harmed by the dietary guidelines. Before the dietary guidelines were created, they got about 40 cents out of every consumer dollar.
So you're saying that they picked winners and losers, in effect, that, you know, certain industries, you know, perhaps the sugar industry, the corn industry, those are the ones that are going through the roof. They're even getting farm subsidies. Yet we've created guidelines which suggest that Americans maybe put that beef and pork at the top of the apex of the food pyramid, you know, and look askance at red meat and butter. That's bad. You know, that whole thing.
Right. Well, and the reason for this is that the dietary guidelines were, they were actually meant to be sort of anti-corporate, and that plan sort of backfired on them because these big food corporations did take up the idea that, oh, we can now manufacture low-fat, low-cholesterol, low-saturated fat processed foods. We'll buy them, and they'll avoid these whole foods, butter, meat, eggs, that contain these scary ingredients that we've said that you should limit or avoid. But at the same time, there's a great deal of ideology associated with the dietary guidelines, that it's scientific ideology, it's this sort of romantic back to nature ideology that really has nothing to do with the food industry. The food industry reacted to it and took advantage of it, for sure.
Right, because they said, in effect, you know, okay, if you want your skim milk, well, fine. You know, we create a product that we can charge just as much for, then we'll extract the fat and we'll sell it to somebody else.
And we can
We can sell that, too. You want high fat, you want low fat, you know, whatever. Yeah. We'll do whatever you want.
Yeah, the dairy industry definitely benefited, because they ended up getting two production streams out of this. So they could remove the fat and then make money off the fat. But then, you know, the meat and egg folks did not, you know, they really couldn't do much. You can't take the fat out of meat very easily. You can't take the cholesterol out of an egg yolk very easily and without processing them. And that's, of course, what happened. We have ended up with egg beaters and things like that.
Well, some Americans, you know, I got to say, we I think are attuned to this message, but I think some Americans are horrified when someone like you has the temerity to suggest, and many nutrition authorities now come over to this. There was an article in the New York Times today that says that schmaltz is making a comeback. Did you see that article? It's like chicken fat. Chicken fat is suddenly being recognized now as a health food, and that the harms of all that saturated fat, you know, you're supposed to take the skin off the chicken, eat the, you know, the skinless breast, you know, dry meat is preferable to the, you know, greasy chicken drippings, and yet that's precisely what that is. People collect that, and you know, my grandparents, I remember sitting down at the kitchen table, they would get a coarse slice of dark bread, and they would mm-hmm. schmear schmaltz yep. on that. It would be like a delicacy, and you know, now we've stigmatized that. But so let's look at some of the scientific evidence that now is vindicating meat and saturated fat, these things that were so villainized in the dietary guidelines.
Well, so that science has been there all along. I guess that's the first thing I would want people to know, that this is not scientists waffling and changing their minds. The science has been there all along. It's just that one segment of it was silenced, because when the dietary guidelines came out, it also directed how nutrition research was done. And so if your research protocol did not meet with the standards of what we were calling a healthy diet in the dietary guidelines, then you were a lot less likely to get funded. So nutrition science has never settled this question about whether saturated fat and cholesterol cause heart disease or are good for you or not. And the jury was out in 1970, first dietary goals and guidelines, and the jury is still out. There's a great deal of controversy that surrounds it. But I think what we're seeing, as the science does, I mean, this is what science does, is that you have competing hypotheses, and if science is allowed to work the way that science should work, then as it progresses, we begin to realize that the stronger science is ending up on one side versus the other. I don't think we're there yet, but the problem is that we've already settled the policy. So while these questions of fact still remain, we've already established a policy as if the science has been settled.
Well, so in other words, we sometimes cherry-pick the facts to fit the narrative that we want.
Yep.
And what you're suggesting is that we change the narrative to accommodate the science.
That's what I think needs to be done. I think that we need to go back and we need to say, what can we say based on the science that we do have now, that we have consensus on? And it's not that we should limit or avoid saturated fat and replace those things with vegetable oils. That consensus isn't there, and it's never.
And by the way, that still is up there as the, from time to time, I check the American Heart Association dietary guidelines, and, you know, I think, well, maybe, you know, 3 months later it'll change, but they still say replace butter and high-fat dairy with skim milk and low-fat dairy, and substitute the fatty saturated fats for vegetable oils. They actually still say that.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
the omega-6 oils are associated with a lot of problems.
Right. And what? Yes, and exactly. And what's really disturbing about this is that the 2015 Dietary Guidelines Advisory Committee has been talking about how they're backing away from this low-fat message, and really it hasn't been helpful to the health of Americans to have Americans reduce the fat content of their diet. So they've backed away from that message, but here's the really disturbing part, is that they want to maintain the limits or even lower the limits on saturated fat, so that what they're increasing the window for is more intake of those vegetable oils that you've mentioned.
Nice.
So it's, you know, they still want us eating lean meat. They still want us avoiding eggs. They still want us drinking skim or fat-free milk and lots of grains and cereals along with our fruits and vegetables. And then removing the cap on the fat percentage of our diet or raising it will allow for not more natural whole fats from animals, but more vegetable oils from these giant processing plants.
I see what you're saying. So they're hearing the message, but they're sort of misinterpreting the message. They're saying, oh, you know, now there's evidence that fat is not all that bad for you, but let's make sure that, you know, it's plenty of, you know, safflower oil and, you know, canola.
Soybean oil.
Soybean oil. Corn oil. Right. Corn oil. Because Turns out that fat's not so bad for you. So those are the sources that we should select. But God forbid we should get cholesterol in our bodies, because we know cholesterol kills you, and we know that, and everybody knows that saturated fat, you know, that gunk that you see, you know, that you cut off the side of meat, that's going to go directly into your arterial wall and clog it. I mean, it makes sort of intuitive sense. I mean, you see the fatty atheroma that people have, you know, in the autopsies, and you say, well, that kind of looks like the stuff that I trim off my porterhouse steak.
Yeah, only the picture, as you know, is a lot more complicated.
Exactly,
than that,
so. Exactly.
And we have oversimplified the message. We've oversimplified the things that we can assume based on science. And I think what is sort of misunderstood, we talk a lot about the food industry and how the food industry maybe is influencing the direction of the dietary guidelines. I think what gets lost sometimes is the extent to which on the other side of the table, the Department of Health and Human Services, which is supposed to be sort of watching out for our national health, they have a tremendous vested interest in keeping these dietary guidelines the way they are. They have a number of programs and practices that have been in place for a long time telling Americans to reduce their intakes of cholesterol, the National Cholesterol Education Program, all of that sort of things. And so how would it look for them to to go back on that, to say, oh, we were wrong? I mean, imagine the liability.
Yeah. We actually have a precedent for that, because I believe it's one of the Scandinavian countries, I don't remember which, but perhaps it's Denmark, Sweden, that has reversed course on the dietary recommendations where they tell people to have less fat. Now they're saying basically have plenty of saturated fat. They're saying reduce sugar and simple carbohydrates. Am I mistaken? Because I think that's the beginning of an international trend that might encourage America to follow suit.
Yeah, well, let's hope so. let's hope so. I'm not familiar with the details. I don't know if they're encouraging the consumption of saturated fat as much as they're just saying
animal protein.
And there's just no restrictions on it, which
right.
is, you know, frankly, what I would be happy with that if we if we allowed people to have these whole foods as part of their diet and they weren't restricted and they weren't discriminated against, I think, strong of a word. Because as you said, you know, schmaltz, that's a traditional food. In my family's Polish, kielbasa.
Yep.
You know, that's a traditional food. For other...
In the south of America, it was chitlins.
Yep. And greens and fatback.
Right.
Chorizo and eggs and all of these traditional foods that were considered nourishing.
In Puerto Rico, it's a chicharron, which is fried pork rinds.
Absolutely. And we've essentially told people, your traditional foods are not appropriate. Your traditional foods are not healthy. The only traditional foods that we are going to condone are the Japanese traditional foods. And I think that's inappropriate for a country as diverse as America.
I'm not even sure the Japanese eat a lot of granola and low-fat yogurt, though.
Yes, that's true.
You know what I'm saying? Because I think, in a way, I mean, if you look at it historically, that was sort of an aberration that was introduced by a guy named Kellogg, who was a bit of a health nut who believed that people should consume lots and lots and lots and lots of fiber to get the bowels working.
Right.
And, you know, had also a pretty ingenious idea, which is that you could take grains, roll them flat, put them in a box, and jack up the price and turn that into America's favorite breakfast instead of bacon and eggs.
And his nutritional principles were also very much based on ideology rather than science.
Yes.
This was, you know, he was a vegetarian. He was planning on, so the cereal was meant to suppress sexual interest.
Yes.
It was very much about, you know, controlling people and controlling their lives. And, you know, I'm not sure that there's not some of that going on right now with these dietary guidelines, especially with the sort of mission creep into the area of sustainability and the area of, you know, that we're going to tell. So even if the science falls through on saturated fat and cholesterol, and we can't tell people not to eat meat because yep. it contains saturated fat and cholesterol, we're still going to tell people not to eat meat because cows are damaging to the environment. And there's no acknowledgement of the, you know, again, hundreds of thousands of years of the place that livestock has had in sustainable agricultural practices.
Right. Well, that's interesting because there is the mix. They say, well, you know, even if it's not healthier, it's better for the planet. It's going to, you know, the cow emissions can add to global warming.
Right.
It's, you know, high on the food chain. It's poor land utilization. That whole thing kind of gets mixed in with it. But you also, in your letter, and we're going to get your letter soon, we'll talk specifics about what that letter contains because it's a beautiful letter. I think all of our listeners should go over to forahealthynation.org and read the letter in its entirety and sign on to it and send it to your legislators and send it to, I guess it's going to be the USDA or the FDA or whichever.
Yep, USDA.
But another issue that you tackle head on is the issue of sodium and sodium restriction and the notion that virtually every man, woman, and child in the United States should drastically curtail their sodium intake. Good idea? Bad idea?
We just don't have the, again, this has been a controversy from the start, and the science is very much contradictory. We know that reducing sodium reduces blood pressure. I don't think that anybody really debates that. If you're a clinician and you can get somebody to reduce the sodium in their diet, you can probably reduce their blood pressure.
If they have high blood pressure. If they have high, that's what I've noticed.
Right. But it may be temporary. It may not last. Reducing sodium doesn't work on that.
It has
well.
A paradoxical effect. Yeah, actually,
yes.
I've done some
yep.
research on this, and there are some people who paradoxically, their blood vessels constrict when they don't get enough sodium. So that's sometimes.
It's very mixed, and the dietary guidelines don't acknowledge that the outcomes are very different for different individuals. So you're right. There's this notion, especially so for everyone who's African-American and anyone over the age of 50, you're supposed to be restricting your sodium intake to less than a teaspoon of sodium a day. And the idea is that this is going to lower blood pressure and prevent chronic disease. Well, it might or it might not lower blood pressure, but we don't have indication that it's going to prevent chronic disease. We're not looking at those outcomes, and they've never looked at those outcomes.
I guess one of the big issues that you have is with a one-size-fits-all approach, and it very well may be that for some people, vegetarian diet, low-fat diet may be very salutary. That depends on their condition, their genetics, their age, sex, whatever. But as a population-wide or societal imperative, maybe not such a good idea.
Yeah, so in public health, nutrition guidelines for prevention of chronic disease are misguided, just, you know, as public health. That's not what public health is supposed to do. Your risk of a chronic disease is different from my risk of a chronic disease. You know, I may not have heart disease in my family. These guidelines are very much focused on heart disease. Diabetes may be more of a problem in my family, and so what I eat should reflect that level of risk. But these guidelines are one size fits all, although I have to point out that, again, the rhetoric of the 2015 Dietary Advisory Guidelines Committee is that, oh, we have guidelines that will suit all Americans and all of their cultural food practices and traditional food mm-hmm. ways. And then they say, and these diets that will benefit all Americans are the DGA diet, mm-hmm. vegetarian vegan diets, the DASH diet, which is a low sodium diet, mm-hmm. the Mediterranean diet, which, I don't have any problems with it, but that's a Mediterranean diet. It's not a Polish diet or a Jewish diet or
mm-hmm.
Scandinavian
or an African
diet.
Right.
Or, yeah. You know, so they've still kept the diets that they consider appropriate to this very narrow plant-based guidance.
Mm-hmm.
And it's still very limiting in meat, in eggs, in butter, in whole natural animal fats. And they're not going to work for everybody.
Well, absolutely.
So, again, we're looking at ideology.
Right. All right. Well, this is a good inflection point for us to pause because we divide these podcasts into two parts. So in part two, coming up, we're going to talk specifics about your excellent letter drafted to the powers that be, the FDA and legislators who are concerned about setting nutrition policy in this country. ForAHealthyNation.org is the website. We're talking to Adele Height. And in just a moment, we'll talk about a letter that, if we inundate Washington with signatures, may change the course of nutrition and may change the course of health in America. We need to do something because we're headed off the cliff. And no matter how much we lavish on our high-tech medical care, it may not prevent a future generation from living less long and less healthily than previous generations. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. We'll be right back.